You're listening to The New Yorker Out Loud. This is Matt Dellinger for NewYorker.com. This week in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker, Adam Gopnik writes about the art of magic, and Adam is our guest this week on The New Yorker Out Loud. Adam, welcome.
Hi, Matt. Wonderful to be here.
Tell me about magic and how it exists today. I think we all know there's a couple of big names like Penn and Teller and David Copperfield and David Blaine. But you mentioned a couple of smaller outlets for magic in New York City.
Well, one of them is Monday Night Magic, which is where this piece began. It's a wonderful kind of inspired jam session of magicians. And I started going there with my family a few summers ago. And I began to sort of insinuate myself into the company of those magicians, and particularly Jamie Ian Swiss, who's one of the producers of the show and who's considered to have one of the best sleight of hand techniques in the world, and who is also a writer, I discovered, an essayist like me, a kind of intellectual of magic. And we began having really impassioned conversations about what magic was and what it meant. And that, more than anything else, was the springboard for me into wanting to write a piece.
And what were your ideas about magic going into this before you?
Well, like everyone, I had been, as a small boy, I had been I'd had a magic set and I'd done the color vision box and I'd amazed with kind of what I learned now are called gaffes. That is, tricks that just involve apparatus or that are self-working. I was never skilled enough to do sleight of hand. And my idea of it was that it was essentially a charming but not just a fringe art, which Jamie Ian Swiss, for instance, will say himself, but one that didn't have a lot of intellectual depth, that didn't have ideas behind it. And I was humbled to discover that the history of magic is not just rich with ideas, but has as many sharp minds in it debating its meanings as any field I've ever known.
And Swiss has some pretty strong opinions about
Swiss. Jamie is, and everybody, even his enemies in the magic world call him Jamie because it's that kind of small subculture, is one of the most beautifully opinionated people I've ever known. He's one of the most authentic intellectuals I've ever met, in the very simple root sense that he cannot help but argue about ideas. He would have been at home in the 1940s in the Partisan Review crowd arguing about prosody and the poetry of Delmore Schwartz, but as it happens, he's alive now arguing about the right handling on twisting the aces or on why magic matters in a time when it doesn't seem to. I guess, Matt, in a sense, that's what this piece is really about.
Yeah.
Magic, in a lot of ways, has been dying for the whole of the last century, because once movies, which magicians helped create, by the way, once special effects in particular were in existence, there's very little that a magician could do that could truly astound you. At the end of the 19th century, if you went to see Carter, one of the great illusionists, there was nothing like it in the world. Women disappeared.
It was exclusively a live act, obviously.
Exclusively a live act, exclusively a stage show. Once you can make women disappear just with the dissolve, what could you do on stage?
Mm-hmm.
So slowly, magic has been receding over that time. But at the same time, it's held on. And it reminded me, as you know, I used to be the art critic around this place, and I care a lot about modern art. And it reminded me very much of the predicament of the modern artist. On the one hand, painting in the age of photography and the media image, sort of, who needs it anymore? Who really wants it? And yet it holds on, and it holds on by making itself important in another way. So that kind of analogy between magic and, if you like, the disappearing arts was one that appealed to me very much.
And what are Jamie's sort of the tenets of his philosophy?
Jamie is a disciple, like most interesting magicians, of Di Vernon, who was, I'm proud to say, a Canadian. But the essence of what Vernon was about and what Jamie believes in is naturalness. That is, the idea that everything a magician does should not look like magic. It should have a completely unforced and casual look. Jamie doesn't even like having to say, I hold here in my hands an ordinary deck of cards. Even then, you're already crossing the line into something that's self-consciously magic.
And if you saw him, you wouldn't say, oh, he's a magician. He's not dressed as a...
No, he's not dressed in tie and tails. You'd say, at all. No, and rejects that. So naturalness is one part of what he and most good magicians believe in. But the other part of it is, and that it's very distinctive, I think, to Jamie, and which I try and articulate in this piece, is the idea that magic isn't sort of make-believe occult. In other words, it isn't that magicians are trying to make you think there is really magic in the world, of which they have some remnants. He thinks that magic is a wonderful instance of the way the mind works. We're constantly trying to understand the world. And what the magician does is he gives us something that we can't understand. And the goal of the magician is to create a trick at once so natural and so beautiful that we say, I know it was a trick, but I can't for the life of me imagine what trick it was. That's what a magician is trying to do. And by doing that, it opens our minds.
You got to visit with a lot of magicians. I'm interested to know, well, first of all, their spaces. you mentioned Copperfield's collection and Teller's very strange house.
Some of the magicians I visited with are wealthy and have huge establishments like Copperfield. Some live very modestly. And what was striking about them is how each of them had sort of invented an environment that was sort of shaped to their own needs. Teller lives in one of the most interesting houses I've ever seen.
Now, he's the one that doesn't talk, but he...
On stage, he doesn't talk, but in person is one of the most voluble and articulate and painstakingly precise people I've ever conversed with. And what he's all about is this wonderful kind of expressionist house outside Las Vegas. One of the things that was interesting for me, Matt, in writing this was to discover that sort of the last place where big magic, big illusionist shows hang on is in Las Vegas. And people expect live entertainment in Las Vegas. They want to be impressed in that way. People, I think Americans also sort of take a break from television when they go to Las Vegas. It's sort of the one place where live entertainment is still the norm rather than the exception. Mm-hmm. So magic works very well in that environment. And so all of these magicians who once were in New York City or in Los Angeles now are scattered through the desert hills around Las Vegas because that's where the work is.
Yeah, you've also got in Vegas, gambling is a little bit like you want magic to happen.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that it suits somehow. Also, you know, something else is that one of the funny things about close-up card magic, you have to be good at cards, exactly. You have to be, cards have to be part of the norm of your life. And in Las Vegas, cards are certainly part of the norm of life.
So if you look at all of these modern magicians, how do they differ? I mean, how would they explain magic differently? And is it just a matter of style, or do they actually have different philosophies?
I think that there are sort of two broad points of view. They're not as precise or as organized, regimented as schools. One point of view, which Jamie Ian Swiss is passionate for, that I think Penn and Teller share in another way, is that part of the glory of magic is its traditions, is its accumulated craft. Anybody can learn how to do a trick, but the real work is the accumulated practice of performing the trick in a completely convincing way. And so they, in some sense, believe in the tradition. They believe that magic, as it's been understood for 200 years, still has a great deal to give us, a great deal to tell us about our own minds, about the nature of explanation. It's just entertaining. It can just be fun. And then there are people like David Blaine, who I've come to have a great regard for, who basically think that that kind of magic, however wonderful it may be, is essentially there for magicians. It's there for cultists. It's there for insiders. And that the future of magic as an entertainment, magic as an art form, lies in a kind of crossover with reality. David Blaine sees himself not as a magician, though he does lots of wonderful magic, but as an endurance artist. And he believes that the credibility of his stunts, standing on a pole for 24 hours, or as he's planning to do this fall, as he told me, going sleepless for 12 days, that it has to be real. People have to believe that there is no trick involved. So he was heavily influenced by performance artists who did exactly those kinds of stunts in an art context 20 years ago. So he wants magic to become more and more like performance art, I suppose like reality television, and move farther and farther away from its base in craft and technique. And as a writer, I identify with the conservatives, if you like. I identify with the people who believe in technique and craft. As a writer, that's what we all struggle to do, is to master technique and craft. And yet I recognize the immediacy, the urgency, the excitement of what David Blaine and other magicians like him are trying to do.
Well, it's interesting. I remember there was some confusion, at least anecdotally among people I knew, when he did his trick where he was buried alive. Mm-hmm. You're thinking along the lines of magic, and you're thinking, well, how did he do that? And the case is he did it.
The way Blaine does his tricks is to do them. If he stays awake for 12 days, he stayed awake for 12 days. He said to me once, Penn and Teller do a wonderful variant of one of the great classics of stage magic, the bullet catch, where someone fires a gun at you and a magician appears to catch a bullet between his teeth. David Blaine said to me, if I did the bullet catch, I would have somebody shoot a bullet in my arm. And he really believes in that. And in fact, Chris Burden, the performance artist who influenced him, did exactly that, was shot in the arm as a piece of performance art.
Well, tell me about... you mentioned the word exposure and how magicians don't appreciate really having their secrets spread around. And yet there is also a culture, it seems, of apprenticeship in magic.
Magic is a lot like music, both in the sense that you sort of get the bug when you're 12. Mm-hmm. Boys, particularly, I think, you know, that moment when you think it's crucially important to memorize everybody's RBI in the American League, or when you learn every chord in the book and you play the guitar in the bathroom, or you do magic tricks. And as a consequence, there's a kind of pool of young magicians, 12 and 13-year-olds, who are always present around magic. And some magicians are very threatened by that. They don't want their work to be confused with kid magic. And some, like Jamie Swiss, welcome it. They recognize that that's part of what makes magic magical, is the, right. The way that it enables awkward 12-year-old boys to suddenly feel not just socially adept, but to suddenly have a feeling of mastery for the first time. And that's part of the pathos and beauty of magic, is that it preserves some of that adolescent moment.
Well, and it's unusual. You say it's unusual for people to start late. I guess there's something in magic that's attractive or interesting to a child that later on for an adult maybe isn't, or?
I think so. One of the questions is why women rarely do magic. And I think that people lose the magic bug. You know, we outgrow it just as we outgrow the electric guitar, some of us, and some of us never do, and it's a blessing when we don't.
Right.
But I think that a lot of people think of magic as being, you know, Jerry Seinfeld has a funny, bitter little bit about it. He doesn't understand why anybody's interested in magic. He goes, he sees it, he's fooled, he knows it's a trick. So what? I'm fooled.
Yeah.
But if you have a taste for the shock of the mysterious, for that feeling, wonder is an overused word, but that sudden thrill when you realize, oh my God, I know that was done by human craft, but what possible human craft could accomplish that? And that feeling, if you're vulnerable to it, is like no other in the arts.
And this is why it's so different in person. I mean, when you see on TV David Copperfield makes the Statue of Liberty disappear, you just think...
It's meaningless. It's one of the... I think it was Teller who said to me that it's not just that magic doesn't work well on television, is that television is a denial of everything that magic is, because magic depends on the notion that someone is suspending the laws of nature in your presence, in your space. Well, once it's happening on a screen that's defined in advance as flat, illusory, and remote, what's the force of it? It has no force left. Television denies what magic is. And again, one of the things that I find moving and stirring about magic and magicians is they know they can't compete with that. Just the way those of us who write and believe in the craft of writing in some way can't compete with the mass media. And yet they persist. And that persistence, I think, has something very beautiful in it.
I wonder what the internet has done for magic. Has it been a boon? I mean, do people go on and does it make it more accessible?
Very much the children of David Blaine fill the internet. If you go on YouTube, you can find thousands upon thousands of kids demonstrating their moves. Mm-hmm. Doing tricks for each other, for themselves. In that sense, the internet's been very good for magic. My friend Jamie Swiss is skeptical of that because he feels that one of the basic reasons for magic is to make shy kids social. So if you have shy kids performing for the cameras of their computers and putting it on YouTube, it's meaningless. It hasn't accomplished anything. Jamie Ian Swiss said to me once, the one thing in the world I can do that Steven Spielberg can never do is say to you, take a card, any card, and then have you sign the card and put it back in the deck. Spielberg can take you to the ends of the galaxy and the center of the earth. He can make 1,000-foot-tall bugs, but he can't lean out to the audience and say, take a card, take any card you want.
Yeah.
And it's that meeting of minds, it's that shared space, it's that naturalism that makes magic essential.
Thank you very much for joining us, Adam.
Pleasure to talk, man.
Adam Gopnik's piece, The Real Work, is in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker, which also features Hendrik Hertzberg on John McCain's next move, Ryan Lizza on Hillary's persistence, Alec Wilkinson on a rare photo album of life at Auschwitz, Anthony Lane's review of Funny Games, Jill Lepore on the HBO miniseries John Adams, Peter Sheldahl on the Whitney Biennial, and a short story by John Burnside. You can subscribe to this and other free podcasts on our website, newyorker.com, or visit the iTunes Music Store and search for New Yorker. For The New Yorker, this is Matt Dellinger.